he said again, helplessly.
"What about your friend?" asked Rafa. "He's no carpenter's son, that's plain. Maybe he knows someone who'll pay."
Cade felt the last of his hope sink away. It always came back to Aaron. Aaron who made the decisions. Aaron who had the money and the privilege, and who'd ruined it all for some Croden girl Cade had secretly thought little of. Cade had never even been given the chance to make that mistake. He was born poor and would stay poor. His destiny was directed by others. Only by clinging to Aaron could he hope to change it. Cade had no value without him. He couldn't stand alone, and that knowledge emptied him. But he wouldn't ask Aaron for help. It would be the final act of wretchedness to slink back to him that way. All that was left was the mine, the tiredness and the pain, the black horror that faced him every morning. That was all, forever. Rafa sat back and spread his hands.
"You're not making it easy for me to help you."
Cade felt tears stealing into his eyes, his throat clamping up, and was too miserable to be ashamed of it. "I have to get out of the mine," he pleaded, as if the raw need in his voice might sway matters. The man next to him snickered, and Rafa shot him a sharp look. The pirate dug in his pocket, leaned forward, and held up a small cylinder of waxed paper.
"Take this," he said. "Chew on it when you work. It'll make you feel good, feel strong. Make the day pass like a dream. That'll last you the week. Come back after and we'll talk."
Cade knew what it was. Ragweed. He opened his mouth to say he didn't want it, because the very thought of it scared him. But he didn't know how to reject a gift from a man like Rafa.
"I know why you're here, brother," the pirate said. "Threw yourself in the path of the Iron Hand for your friend. Wouldn't be the first time a commoner paid the price for the doings of the highborn."
He took Cade's hand and put the packet of ragweed into his open palm.
"There's no nobles in Rafa's kingdom, but even the lowliest man gets to feel like a lord. You don't have to suffer any more."
The unexpected sympathy made Cade's eyes well up again, and he lowered his head to hide it. Rafa folded his fingers closed over the ragweed plug, then sat back in his chair.
"Thank you," Cade whispered.
17. The next day dawned bright and clear, and though the air was cold, the sun warmed the prisoners' faces as they made their way up the mountain to the mine. Aaron had passed a restless night, haunted by dreams in which a tattered boy with bright green eyes watched him malevolently from the rafters. But in the safety of the light, his fears faded, and he confided what had happened to Jan, who was on mining detail that day.
"You saw Rags!"
Jan exclaimed, loud enough for others to overhear. Hendry, Aaron's dishevelled workmate, leaned in.
"You saw the dead boy?"
"Other people have seen him, then?" asked Aaron, wiping his nose with the back of his hand. He'd caught a cold from his escapades last night, and it had given him a foggy head.
"They'll tell you they did,"
Hendry said with a pointed look at Jan. Jan gave Hendry a hurt look, or possibly Aaron. His lazy eye made it hard to tell.
"I saw him right enough, coming from behind the cookhouse. It was after curfew, but we'd had a fever through the camp and had to boil all the sheets. Hassan gave us passes so we could get them done that night. I was pushing a load to the laundry, and he came darting out like a rat."
"That or the lye fumes went to your head," Hendry scoffed.
Jan gave a sullen glare to Hendry, probably.
"Scared me rigid, he did. And I ain't the only one who's seen him either."
"So who is he?" Aaron asked.
"He's the shade of a sard boy," Jan said. "It's the eyes, see? All sards got that colour eyes. Unsettling folk they are, at the best of times. Twice as much when they're dead."
The eyes. Aaron should have made the connection himself. A family of sards used to pass through Shoal Point with peddlers' stalls now and then, and sometimes a group of caravans would appear on the common for a few months, much to the annoyance of the locals. They were called thieves and tricksters, dirty folk without morals. But the more daring and rebellious townsfolk would associate with them, drawn by their mysterious nature. There was talk of wild nights of music and dancing in their camp, and those who visited came back with strange and unlikely tales of sorceries and bewitchments. Then one day the Sards would be gone without warning, leaving nothing but rumours behind. Aaron remembered their visits from his childhood, but they'd stopped coming in recent years, and Aaron hadn't thought of them for a long time. "Why would the ghost of a Sard be here?" Aaron asked. "No Sards in this camp."
"Ah, but there used to be," Jan said. "It's not just Ossians buried in that dirt."
He tugged the arm of a prisoner walking ahead of them, a weary-looking grey-bearded man who might have been in his 40s or his 60s. "Farrell, tell him."
"Don't drag me into this," Farrell said over his shoulder.
Aaron knew him by reputation. He was a political prisoner, a scholar who'd spoken out against the Croden regime.
"Ghosts and shades and such. There are enough terrible things in this world without making up imaginary ones."
"Tell him about the Sards,"
Jan urged, undeterred. Farrell sighed heavily. It was best to give in to Jan's pestering early. Whether you resisted or not, the result was the same.
"It's true. There were Sards in this camp once. The Crodans kept them in a separate compound over by the latrines. They weren't ever let out, not to work in the mine, nor to mix with the other prisoners. At first there were 50 or 60, women and children too. Then more started coming, a lot more, brought in on wagons until they were crammed in that compound like chickens in a coop."
"Why were they arrested?" Aaron asked. "What did they do?"
"What did any of us do?"
said Farrell, gazing at the thick, dark forest, streaked with hazy sunlight as the morning mist lifted.
"What did you do? Does it matter?"
Aaron thought it did, since he was innocent and had little sympathy for the criminals and traitors incarcerated here, but he kept his silence.
"You'd see them at the fence begging for food," said Farrell, his tone turning darker. "The new arrivals, anyway. The rest had given up trying. There wasn't any spare food to be had, and if there was, you could bet it wouldn't go to a Sard. Most of them just sat there, like they were waiting for something. The children cried, but there was nothing to be done for them. No one knew why they were there, since they weren't being put to work."
Farrell's eyes had become unfocused, and Aaron knew he was seeing those scenes again.
"2 years ago, maybe 3, we woke up to find the villagers taking the fence down around the Sard compound. They'd all been moved on in the night. No word of where they went, and not many missed them. Ossian prisoners were moved into the Sard longhouses, and that was the end of it."
He shrugged and turned away.
"And that's when Rags appeared," Jan jumped in. "He's the shade of some Sard boy buried in the graveyard, and his ma got taken away. So now he wanders the camp at night, searching for her. And he kills crows because everyone knows the crows work for Sala. He don't want them telling the Lady of Worms where he is, in case she calls him away before he's found what he's looking for."
Hendry gave a snort that showed what he thought of that.
"He's no shade," said Farrell. "Plenty say they've seen him. Must be blessed with the mama's own luck to have made it this long in the camp, though."
Jan blew out his lips derisively.
"One Sard boy surviving this whole time on his own? I'd believe anything over that."
He looked around.
"Where's Cade? He'd know what manner of shade Braggs is."
Aaron felt a knot grow in his stomach. "He's about somewhere," he said, and said no more. Aaron's detail were told on arrival that they'd been reassigned to a new location. The route there was different, but little else was. It was another dank, tight, gloomy tunnel held up by splintered beams, from which hung lanterns low enough for a man to hit his head on. A pair of cave pipers fluttered in a rusty cage. Yesterday they'd won a victory over their unyielding enemy, the mountain. Today brought a new wall, and it was as if they'd gained no ground at all. They set to work again, and Aaron swung his pickaxe steadily, not too fast and not too slow. He had no desire to repeat his feat of yesterday. His anger had burned off overnight, and he no longer sought to punish himself. The cheroots were a lost cause, and his business with Grubb was unfinished, but that could wait. There was a more important matter. Cade. He looked down the line and saw Cade hard at it, swinging with rare enthusiasm. Usually he was dull-eyed with misery as he laboured, but today his gaze was bright and fierce. Aaron wondered if it was a change for the better or for the worse. Either way, he intended to find out. The sting of Cade's words had faded with time. The beating he'd taken from Grubb and the encounter in the graveyard had put things into perspective. He and Cade had to stick together if they hoped to survive in this place. A friendship of half a lifetime shouldn't be broken by a few harsh words. He was determined to reconcile them, and if Cade wouldn't ask for forgiveness, then Aaron would be the bigger man and forgive. Yet what was so simple and clear in his mind was muddy and frightening in real life, and he felt sick at the thought of it. To speak from the heart required more bravery than any physical risk. To heal a wound was so much harder than to cause one. But he'd do it, because it had to be done. He wanted his friend back. His opportunity came when they took their break. A prisoner was picked for slop duty, and the others rested against the tunnel walls while they waited for their meagre lunch. Their guard was talking with another guard, barely paying attention to his charges. Cade sat on his own, forearms resting on his knees, head hanging, nodding as though to some rhythm in his mind. Perhaps one of the Ossian folk songs he'd been fond of blaring drunkenly in the cross keys during better times. Aaron slipped up the tunnel and dropped down next to him. "We ought to talk," he said. Cade tilted his head to the side, enough to show one hostile eye. Then he looked back at the ground between his feet, toes tapping restlessly, hands twitching in time. So Cade would give no ground. Well, Aaron would say his piece anyway. "Listen to me," he said. "I know it's my fault that you're here, and..." "It ain't," Cade muttered. Aaron frowned. "Sorry?" "Ain't your fault. I did it. It was my choice." Aaron's planned apology had already fallen apart. "You're right, of course, it was your choice. I just meant, because of me and Sora..." "You really think the moons and the stars revolve around you?" Cade hissed, raising his head. His face was shadowed and scornful in the weak light. "Like your life is a bard's tale with you at the centre. What if it ain't, though? What if all this had nothing to do with you?" Aaron couldn't understand where this was coming from, or indeed what he was talking about. It was so far from sense that he didn't know where to begin. "You think the Crodans have it right, ain't that true?" Cade went on. "Think they've got the measure of the world, better than us Ossians ever did. You trust in their justice." "I mean," Aaron was struggling, "I never said it was a perfect system, but it's the best we have. So what if they knew what they were doing when they came to your house, eh?" Cade snapped, talking over him. "What if justice was done? What if your dad was a traitor?" Aaron went cold, and his voice became flinty and sharp with threat. "My father was a good man." "You can be a good man and a traitor both," said Cade. "Especially if you're ruled by a bunch of squarehead scum who murdered your queen, stole the Ember Blade, and put your people under the boot." Aaron had never witnessed such bold sedition. It shocked and frightened him to hear it from his friend. "Take that back," he cried, but he wasn't sure if he meant the accusation against his father or against the Crodans. But Cade wouldn't be stopped. He was in full flow now, his voice rising, and he was grinning. "Think about it, Aaron. Your da was away all the time. He could have been doing anything. And didn't you say he was up near Salt Fork when the rebels took that town? He was, wasn't he?" Their argument had drawn the attention of the nearby prisoners, and even the guard glanced over and scowled. But Aaron couldn't quiet himself. He believed he could suffer any abuse, absorb any blow to win his friend back, but he was wrong. All his good intentions were pushed aside as rage swelled uncontrollably. He wanted to drive a fist into the face of the stranger before him. This leering, cruel impostor wasn't the friend he knew. "My father was loyal. He raised me like a Croden. Aye, just what I'd do if I wanted to keep my son in the dark." "You're lying." He wouldn't listen, wouldn't let it be true. And yet, there was a horrifying kind of sense to it, if he dared to admit the possibility. Could it be that his rendezvous with Sora had never been discovered, that her father had said nothing to the governor? His father had seemed hunted the night of the ghost tide, and that was before Aaron met with Sora. Had he read something in those letters Aaron hadn't dared ask about? Had he known what was coming? What if justice had been done, and a traitor had been executed? Cade pushed the knife in. "For all your money and education, you're as helpless as I am." He was gloating, actually gloating. "Know why? Because you're an Ossian. They'll let you dream of being like them, but all it takes is a wave of their hand and it's all gone. I reckon your dad knew that. Reckon he was a better man than I gave him credit for. At least he fought back." Aaron lunged at him, seizing him by the throat and driving him up against the tunnel wall. He drew back his fist to silence Cade, but the blow never fell, because Cade was giggling now, a high, manic giggle tinged with madness. Aaron saw his tongue move as he shifted something between his gum and lip, then began to chew. The pieces fell into place. Cade had been behaving strangely all along, but Aaron had been too wound up to see it.
"What have you done?" Aaron breathed.
"You two, settle down," the guard shouted in Croden from along the tunnel. It was plain he didn't want to leave his conversation to deal with them, but the disturbance had become too much to ignore. Aaron paid no attention. His fury had gone out like a candle, snuffed by anxious disbelief.
"You're using ragweed? Are you mad? Don't you know what that does to you?"
Cade stuck out his tongue to show Aaron the soggy wad of black weed there. His smile said, "I don't care."
"You won't last a year chewing that stuff,"
Aaron was pleading now. He could barely believe his friend had done this, that he'd surrender this way.
"You'll work yourself to death and you won't even know it."
"We're already dead," Cade said. "Both of us. I'm just making it easy on myself."
"We are not dead," Aaron shouted. "I won't let us die."
"You can't stop it," said Cade bitterly. "You can't do a thing."
"Curse you, that's enough," snapped the guard.
He came storming up the tunnel, club in hand. The other prisoners shrank back against the wall. Cade and Aaron hardly noticed.
"You keep waiting if you like," Cade sneered. "Keep waiting for Croden justice to set you free. I'm done."
Aaron grabbed the front of Cade's shirt, stared hard into his eyes.
"You're not giving up, Cade," he said. "You're not."
Cade laughed hysterically in his face.
"I warned you, you eel-eating sons of dogs," the guard shouted as he closed on them.
He raised his club, ready to bring it down on Aaron's head. Aaron threw up an arm in instinctive defense, but it was too late to escape the blow. He braced himself for the impact. And the guard froze as a twittering, urgent melody danced through the air. Slowly he turned his head towards the cage where the cave pipers were kept, hanging from a hook driven into one of the beams. The cave piper sang again. It fluffed its breast feathers in agitation, and its companion sang back. 2 dozen terrified men watched their every move. Together they burst into a frenzy, flapping against the bars of the cage, shrilling the alarm that all Ellerite miners dreaded to hear. It was the trigger for chaos. The prisoners surged to their feet, shouting in alarm, some pushing down others in their haste. The guard forgot about Aaron and Cade, and ran for his life in the direction of the mine entrance. His colleague, who'd been guarding a detail in the next tunnel, tried to follow, but ran into the crush of prisoners and was felled by an elbow. There was no fear of Croden's now. Sala herself stood among them. Aaron hauled Cade up with him. Even now, Cade struggled to throw him off, resenting his touch. But Aaron held on until Cade was upright. The cave pipers were silenced as their cage was knocked from its hook and crushed underfoot.
Someone screamed to put out the lantern, doused the flames. A panicked prisoner smashed it where it hung, but instead of bringing darkness, flaming streaks of oil lashed through the air, splattering skin, setting sleeves and trousers afire. The tunnel turned hellish, echoing with screams and lit by the flailing shapes of burning men. A jumbled tide of limbs and shoulders swept Aaron and Cade along. People tried to run, but the shackles round their ankles were too short, and they tripped. A prisoner fell against Aaron, and he staggered and went to his knees, the man's weight across his back. He fought to rise, thrashing with frantic strength, knowing that to go under would mean never coming back up. The prisoner slid off his back and was lost beneath the boots of the stampede. Aaron surged to his feet and plunged onwards as the people behind him tumbled over the fallen man and were trodden down in their turn. Frightened, desperate faces lurched around him. He searched for Cade's, but in the jostle he'd lost him. Ahead was a dim light, the mouth of a larger chamber, where the walls widened, promising relief from the deadly crush. He was carried into it and immediately moved to the side, where he stood, panting, scanning the crowd as they passed, looking for his friend. The chamber was at the junction of several tunnels, one with the entrance painted yellow, indicating the way out. The prisoners hurried for it as fast as their shackles would allow, falling and getting up again, desperation pushing them onwards. But Aaron wouldn't leave until he was sure his friend was safe. All the hard words they'd traded were irrelevant, now the cave pipers had sung.
"Where is he?"
He felt a sudden pressure inside his ears. His hearing went dull. The skin of his cheeks crawled as he sensed disaster. Then there was a sound from deep in the mine, like the footfall of a god, and the mountain shook hard enough to make Aaron stagger. A plume of black dust and smoke shot through with licks of fire, blasted out of the tunnel into the chamber, knocking prisoners flat. Behind it came a crunching, tumbling thunder, as if Meshuk herself, aspect of earth and the fires within, was grinding her stone teeth. It tailed away gradually, until at last a kind of silence returned. By then, the only ones left in the chamber were the fallen and the injured, moaning and sobbing as they tried to pick themselves up again. The fallen, the injured, and Aaron. He coughed as he drew in a lungful of dust. The mountain groaned and cracked uneasily, and every instinct screamed at him to run towards the light. There could be another explosion at any time. The ceiling might collapse and crush him. A rockfall could block the way out, entombing him in a black void beyond imagining. Yet still his feet took him back towards the entrance to the tunnel, because he hadn't seen Cade escape, and so he couldn't be sure. The tunnel was dark, but lit in patches by flickering spots of flame where oil still burned. Smoke and glowing particles swirled in the air. He heard moaning from within, the sound of trapped and wounded men scraping and scratching as they tried to claw themselves free. One wall had collapsed inwards, obstructing the tunnel but not blocking it entirely. It stank of charred pork in there. Hungry as he was, his stomach turned. That wasn't pig cooking. He hesitated at the threshold. Going on was idiocy. Cade was probably halfway to the outside by now. There was no reason to think otherwise. Yet there was something stronger than fear driving him. For all that he dreaded dying down here in the dark, the thought of abandoning Cade was worse. If there was even a chance that he was in there, Aaron couldn't turn away. Though all sense railed against it, he stepped into the tunnel. The dead lay about his feet, scorched and torn. He made himself look at them. Blank eyes stared from bloody and blackened faces. Some he recognized. One of them was Hendry. A prisoner waved the stump of an arm. He sounded like he was trying to call out, but he could only manage strangled gasps.
"Help him," said the sly voice of Cowardice. "You can't leave him like that. Help him to the entrance and the light. Then you can see if Cade is outside."
"Afterwards," he told himself. After he'd made sure. He steeled his will and went on. The timbers of the beams overhead creaked ominously as he eased around the fallen wall. Beyond,
The tunnel continued for a short way before ending in a mass of tumbled stone. The beams had split beneath the sagging ceiling, and the poles that supported them were splintered and broken, unable to bear the terrible weight of the mountain. "Just to the end," he said to himself. If Cade wasn't there, then he could do no more. The air reeked of burning fat. A corpse, face down, still flickered with flame, and shadows jumped back and forth, setting the scene in queasy motion. He made his way deeper into the tunnel, searching the faces of the dead, hoping with all his heart that he wouldn't see Cade among them. He heard men groaning, saw some of them stir. A prisoner he didn't know lurched out of the gloom and staggered past him as if he wasn't there. Horror pressed in on all sides, shortening his breath, forcing itself upon his senses. He flinched away as a tongue of flame ignited in the air above a burning spot of lamp oil. There was still fire fume in the tunnel, and it could be building back up to explosive levels already. "Just to the end," he whispered again. He found a Crodan guard trampled to death beside a half-starved Ossian who'd died the same way. It was said that death made all men equal, but their condition and their clothing told a different story. Only one of them wore shackles. Aaron stared at those shackles. He wondered how many more would have escaped if they'd been able to run. Instead, they died down here, chained like animals, far from the touch of the sun. Whatever crimes they'd committed, nobody deserved such a fate. Crodans would never treat their own people so harshly, but they thought it acceptable for Ossians. Something in his gut curdled and turned bitter at that. How could their masters condone something so barbaric? A wounded guard further down the corridor saw him and began begging for help. Aaron turned towards him, but his heart jumped as he spotted Cade instead, lying motionless on his side, one arm flung across his face. Aaron hurried over, shackles clanking, the guard's cries ignored. "Cade! Cade, I'm here!" He dropped to his knees next to his friend. A grin of relief broke across his face as he saw Cade's chest rise. He patted Cade's cheek, felt the ragweed plug behind his lower lip. On a reflex, he dug out the soggy wad and flung it away in disgust. "Cade!" he said again, and patted him harder. Cade's head lolled to the side, and Aaron saw blood in his blonde hair. Relief faded into dread. There was a long, loud creak above them. Aaron looked up at the bowing beams that held up the tunnel and knew their time was short. He had to get Cade out of there, now. His bruised ribs blazed with agony as he hauled Cade from the ground, and he gritted his teeth to hold back a cry of pain. He shifted Cade's weight onto his back, draping his arms over his shoulders, and stood with a grunt of effort. Cade didn't weigh what he once had, but Aaron wasn't as strong either. It was sheer determination that powered him back down the tunnel, step by shuffling step. The ceiling cracked as the beams split further. The guard began screaming as he saw Aaron leaving him, but Aaron had no help to give. He stumbled between the dead and the mutilated, murmuring a prayer to the Primus that the rock would hold long enough for him to get out. But the sound of Crodan prayer in his ears rang horribly false today, and he found he couldn't continue. His words petered out, and he fell silent. He wouldn't ask for help from the Primus. There was no point. In that moment, something changed within him, deep down in his soul. He'd prayed to the Primus all his life, and all the more fervently after he arrived here, begging for some intervention to save them. No answer had come. No hope was offered, but he prayed anyway because that was all he had. Now, for the first time in his life, his prayers felt empty, just words thrown against the dark. The Primus was a Crodan god, and the Crodans put those shackles on Aaron's legs. The Crodans were responsible for what had happened to Cade. The Primus didn't care about Ossians, not even those who tried their hardest to be Crodan. And if the Primus didn't care about him, then he was no god of Aaron's. Instead, in his desperation,
he directed his appeal to Meshuk, in whose domain he found himself. At least she was a goddess of his own people.
"Stone Mother, save us. I've never worshipped you, but the one I carry does. Let us out of here, and I swear I'll never scorn you again."
He dragged Cade past the collapsed wall and saw the entrance to the chamber ahead, and safety. Inspired by the sight, he hurried on, but was tugged back and almost fell as his shackles snagged on a dead man's boot. He kicked frantically and freed himself, but then he heard a low groan above him and knew the ceiling was about to give. With ferocious effort he surged onwards, an animal cry escaping him as he staggered past his dead countrymen, Cade on his back. Hampered by the shackles, his balance escaped him, and he began to tip forwards, but by some unknown grace his feet stayed under him for the distance, and when he toppled, he fell out of the tunnel mouth and into the chamber beyond. The pain of the impact was drowned out by the terrifying roar from behind him as the tunnel finally caved in. Dust and rock shards billowed all around him, stones crashed and tumbled, and all Aaron could do was fling his hands over Cade's head and tuck his own in, his thoughts lost in the white light of fear. But when it was done, and the last of the rocks had stopped rolling, he was still alive. Aching, panting, he raised his head and looked over his shoulder. Where there had once been a tunnel was only piled rubble. Cade was by his side, still unconscious but whole. Slowly, painfully, he got to his feet, staring at the tunnel in disbelief. Mere instants had separated them from death. It didn't seem possible that they'd come so close and survived. Then Cade coughed weakly, and Aaron was pulled back to the moment. Cade was still injured, perhaps badly, and there was yet work to do. He hauled his friend up once more and began the long, slow journey to the light.
18. It had begun to rain by the time the prisoners returned to the camp. A fine drizzle misted the grim, unshaven faces of the men filing through the east gate. They trudged across the guard section beneath the gaze of Overseer Krent, who watched from his mansion with that omnipresent smile of self-congratulation on his lips, as if this were a day like any other. Once in the yard, with the gate to the guard section securely locked behind them, they hugged themselves and stamped their feet for warmth while they waited to be unshackled. As they were released, Captain Hassan ordered them back to their longhouses until dinner, and most were happy to oblige. They were worn out and weighed down by tragedy, and they wanted the sanctuary of their bunks. When it came to Aaron's turn, he made his way obediently out of the yard, but as soon as he could, he darted off into the alleys and headed for the infirmary instead. His boots splashed through shallow puddles as he hurried through the back ways of the camp, blistered feet rubbing inside wet socks. Every part of him ached. Those muscles that weren't already bruised had been strained by carrying Cade out of the mine. He longed for his bed like the others, but rest was out of the question until he knew his friend was all right. That afternoon had been the longest of his life. In the chaos that followed the explosion, the Crodans had been too busy keeping the prisoners under control to tend to casualties. Only when the rest of the guards from the camp arrived and the Ossians were safely corralled outside the entrance to the mine did they begin to load the wounded onto carts. Aaron saw Cade, still unconscious, bundled in among men with broken limbs and deep gashes, and taken away down the mountain. Those beyond help were hauled aside and abandoned, screaming, until Hassan ordered a guard to put them out of their misery. They were slain within sight of their countrymen, each dispatched with a short, efficient sword thrust between the collarbones into the heart. The men that were last begged for mercy, but their executioner went on with his work until there was silence. He returned grey-faced, and his hand shook as he cleaned and sheathed his sword. There was little talk among the prisoners after that. They were left under guard outside the mine, while other matters were attended to. Hours dragged by. Clouds slid in from the west, and Aaron was left with nothing to do but dwell on Cade's condition.
When they were finally collected by a double-strength escort for the trip back to the camp, Aaron couldn't get to his feet fast enough. The infirmary was a simple, flimsy wooden building standing near the south gate. The road from the gate to the yard was cluttered with carts, busy with villagers from across the bridge and prisoners who hadn't been in the mine. Men hurried from the laundry with bundles of sheets to use as bandages under the watchful eyes of the archers on the stockade walkway. The camp was in a state of emergency, and in the confusion, nobody saw Aaron make his way to the infirmary and thump on the door. It was opened almost immediately by a plump-cheeked Ossian girl, with her hair bundled up under a cloth cap and bloody handprints smeared on her smock. "I need to see my friend," Aaron said. "We're too busy for visitors." She began to close the door, but Aaron grabbed it. "Please," he begged. "I just need to know if he's well. He's about our age, thick-set, dark blonde hair. He was unconscious with a head wound. His name is Cade of Shoal Point." She looked him over uncertainly. "And you are?" "Aaron," he said, "of Shoal Point." Understanding dawned in her eyes. She looked over her shoulder, into the infirmary, then back at Aaron. "Can you make yourself useful?" "Yes," he said, relief making him eager. "I'll help any way I can." She sighed, as if exasperated by her own kindness. "Come on then," she said. "We could do with another pair of hands." The infirmary was laid out much like a longhouse, but twice as wide. Rows of bunks were filled with groaning casualties, and the air was pungent with blood and the sharp stink of poultices and medicines. Villagers and prisoners alike hurried between the beds, carrying buckets and bandages, pausing here and there to offer the touch of a hand or a word of comfort. As Aaron entered, he passed a small room where a lanky, balding apothecary was taking down a phial from shelves that were almost empty. "You know anything about the healing arts? Not shy of blood, are you?" "I learned how to clean and staunch a wound as part of my sword training," Aaron said, "and we studied a little from Harvick's anatomy." Not that he remembered any of it. She gave him a look that was both surprised and impressed. "Maybe we can use you. We're short-handed and short-stocked. Only me and the doctor know how to set a bone or stitch, and I'm only an apprentice yet." She indicated a short, elderly man with spectacles and a long white beard, dressed in a frayed jacket and trousers that were too short for him. He was leaning over a patient and muttering to himself. Dr. Barden was feared, as all doctors were feared by Ossians who had little grasp of Croden methods of healing, but those he'd treated said he was gentle and wise. "You're studying Croden physic?" asked Aaron, surprised and impressed in his turn. "Aye, beats the herb craft the old mothers teach." "But you're a woman? Well spotted. The doctor doesn't hold with the Croden idea that women are only good for staying at home and raising children. I'll never go to the Glass University, and I'll never hold a title, but at least when the doctor's gone, there'll be someone in Sullers Bluff who can do more than crush up a few foul-smelling roots, pray to the aspects, and call it a remedy. Speaking of which, there's a druid about, did you know?" Aaron, distracted by searching for Cade among the bunks, was taken off guard by the question. No. Between the imprisonment and the restless toil, we don't get much news," he said absently. She laughed loudly, making him jump. It seemed jarringly out of place amid all this suffering, and yet it was pleasing to hear, a welcome antidote to the sounds of pain. "You should keep your ear to the ground," she advised, an amused gleam in her eye. "All kinds of thrilling things you might miss." Aaron couldn't help a faint smile. He liked her. She moved quickly and talked quickly, and her face was lively and mobile. It had been a long time since Aaron encountered anyone with vigour to spare. She carried on talking as she dodged between the bunks, leading him further in. "I've lived in Sullers Bluff since I was a cribbling, but I've never seen a druid. Thought they'd all died out, to be honest. But now Red Mabel says she's seen the signs in the forest, and Brack Steeltooth swears he laid eyes on one, though he's half-blind these days, so it's just as likely it was a bear. Still," she scratched under her cap, "there's something out there.
The animals have been acting spooked ever since the season turned, and you hear cries off the peaks at night that don't come from any wolf or beast I know.
I see them!
A shriek lifted above the moans and the pleas of dying men calling for their mothers.
I see them!
There's your friend now, she said, making his racket. A moment later, Aaron saw him, lying on a low bunk in the corner of the room. His head was bandaged and he was awake, but his eyes were wide and he was staring at something no one else could see.
They stalk the shifting lands around me,
he shouted, and thrust out a finger to point at nothing.
Skin thin as tissue, eyes dead as stone.
His voice dropped to a conspirator's whisper.
They can't see me, not unless I show myself, but I never will.
Aaron hurried to him, alarmed. What's wrong with him? He asked as he knelt down by Cade's side. We don't know. He took a bad knock, but he's not carrying a fever and there's no other injury we can find. Best we can guess is that his wits have been addled by the blow to the head. Will it pass? Aaron asked, distraught. Maybe, she said with optimism. Then her face fell a little and she said, maybe not.
Kel,
a young Croydon boy came hurrying up.
The doctor needs you. Amputation.
Kel became brusque and businesslike. Keep him quiet as best you can. Talk to him. Let him hear the voice of someone he knows. It might bring him back to sense.
Dr. Barden says to see the apothecary on the way,
the boy told her in Croydon as they hustled off.
Dracontears? Yes.
Aaron was left gazing helplessly at Cade as he rolled his eyes and raved.
I've walked the streets of Caradhis, jewel of the Second Empire, where the blood of the sorcerer kings flows in the gutters,
Cade said.
I've seen the under-cities of the Urds where my ancestors were enslaved, and walked in the shadow of Ashgrak's mountain where his body smoulders still. But this is no place for the living. Only ghosts tread these lands.
Aaron seized his friend's hand, clasped it in both of his. The sight of Cade in such a state frightened him. It would be too much to bear if Aaron had rescued him from death, only to condemn him to madness. Talk to him, Kel had said. And say what? His mind was a blank.
Cade, he said. Cade, do you hear me? Do you know where you are? The Shadowlands, where castles melt like wax and oceans turn to steam. No, no, you're in the infirmary, Cade, and I'm right here. I feel them, stirring in their prison.
He sat up suddenly, clasped Aaron's forearm, and stared hard into his eyes, features slack with fear.
The outsiders,
he shrieked. Then he flung himself down on his yellowed pillow and began to mumble gibberish.
You're dreaming,
Aaron said, his voice weak and pleading. And yet he wondered if that were true. Was it not said that the mad were shade-touched, that their souls had strayed across the divide into the Shadowlands where the spirits dwelled? Once he'd have dismissed such thoughts as legends and superstitions, fragments of a fallen empire, Ossian fancies that didn't belong in the new order of things. But he wasn't so sure of himself anymore. He clasped Cade's hand harder, willing him back from the brink. There was a time when life hadn't been a bleak, grinding procession of days, when they'd run free with the sun on their faces and the breath of the sea in their ears. Aaron wanted to be back there now, more than anything, and it was that yearning which finally loosened his tongue.
You're not in the Shadowlands, he said. You're not in the infirmary either. I'll tell you where you are. Remember the shipwreck, Cade? That old Ellaroo galleon on the beach at Shoal Point? That's where we are. Both of us. And I'm hiding. I'm hiding from Dara and Jed and Ham. You remember that day? I bet you do. That was the day we met.
The ship's name was Wave Dancer, or so old Mattock the Learned told the town before he died, and it was said he could read the tongue of the Ellaroo. It was also said that it had been on the beach since the days of Kala the Dawnwarden, who kept watch from the tower on the cliffs, and that it was a remnant of the invasion force she helped repel.
That was less probable, for even Eleru galleons would rot and break after so many centuries. More likely, it had been driven onto the coast by a storm, but that didn't make for such an exciting tale, so most of the townsfolk preferred the other explanation. There were other tales about the Wave Dancer, too. Dark tales that crowded the mind of the 8-year-old boy racing towards it. That boy was Aaron, all limbs and angles, his arms pumping as his sandals pounded the hot sand. To his left were the cliffs, patched with hardy salt-loving shrubs, where petrels fussed about their nests. To his right was the sea, bright beneath the burning blue sky of a summer afternoon. Behind him were three boys with sticks in their hands, baying for his hide. Jed, Ham, and Dara had chased him all the way from the town and down the switchback wooden stairs from the cliffs. An hour ago they'd been playing seek and tap through the winding stone alleys of Shoal Point, darting like cats among the bun sellers. It had been Aaron's idea to play, and they'd followed his lead, as they usually did. But then the day had turned, and they'd turned on him, and now Aaron was on the run. He'd get more than a tap if they caught him. The galleon loomed before him. It had foundered on the rocks not far from the shore, and listed to starboard, with its prow tilted upwards. The impact had toppled the masts, and the stern had broken free and lay half-submerged nearby. Barnacles encrusted its hull below the tide mark. Droppings splattered its decks. Sea air and sun had bleached and chewed its planks and gunwales. Yet it was still elegant in its ruin, a sleek silver vessel built by strange crafts unknown to men. Looters had long since taken anything of value from inside, but the carcass had remained largely undisturbed. Eleru Whitewood defeated all but the hardest sores, harder than anyone in Shoal Point possessed, and it was thought to bring ill fortune to those who took it into their homes. Stories were told of an Eleru captain who'd been pierced through the heart by a broken spar when his ship ran aground, whose shade walked the decks with a witch-iron sabre, ready to slay any humans foolish enough to find themselves aboard when night fell. Beyond the shipwreck, the beach tapered into the sea, and the cliffs reached out to cut off the sand. There was nowhere for Aaron to run, nowhere to hide from the beating that was coming. Nowhere but the galleon. The tide was out, and the rocks that had smashed the hull were exposed, a jagged ridge that humped out of the sea onto the beach like the spine of some buried leviathan. Chest heaving beneath his sweat-damped shirt, Aaron climbed the ridge and scrambled out towards the decayed and brooding hulk.
"Where are you going, Aaron?" Jed cried as they reached the feet of the rocks. "Come back and get what's owed to you."
"Watch out for the captain's shade," Dara called gleefully.
"Don't be stupid. It's dangerous in there," pleaded Ham, who was kind-hearted and quite fond of Aaron, despite temporarily planning to beat him up.
Aaron didn't listen. He didn't care what they said, as long as they didn't follow, and they didn't sound eager to do that. The waves pushed up against the ridge below him as he hurried on, clambering hand and foot along the sun-dried stone. When he reached the hole in the galleon's flank, he stopped and looked back. The boys were watching him uncertainly, hoping he'd change his mind. Chasing him across a beach was one thing. Braving the galleon was something else entirely.
"You can't hide in there. We're not scared of any Eleru," Jed called,
but he made no move to climb the rocks.
"Leave me alone," Aaron yelled.
With no other options left, he climbed through the gap in the hull. Inside was a jumble of splintered planks that shifted and creaked with the movement of the sea. Below, he could see salt waves lapping around the smashed lower decks, jagged edges ready to impale him if he fell. He picked his way gingerly through the mess, testing each spot before moving ahead. The boards squeaked alarmingly beneath his weight, but they didn't give way. He climbed through a narrow doorway into a cramped chamber and leaned up against the wall, relieved to have solid wood beneath his feet. Once he'd caught his breath, the distress of pursuit faded away to be replaced with a more subtle form of terror. A child's fear of the monster in the dark, of dead things in dead places. But though he dreaded to go further in, he couldn't stay where he was,
the others might still decide to follow, and if Aaron was to escape a thrashing, he needed to keep moving. The interior of the gallon was claustrophobic and stuffy with heat. Slices of white sunlight cut through gaps in the boards overhead, illuminating strange, sad corridors, warped and scabbed with the passing of empty years. Everywhere he saw touches of Eluru craft, wood made to flow like water. The cornices over the doorways were works of art. The walls were chased with carven motifs of leaf and vine. This galleon had been a thing of beauty once, before it fell to must and mould. Rats scattered ahead of him as he trod along sloping floors. Timbers moaned as the galleon rocked with the waves sloshing in its belly. Had he gone far enough? Maybe they hadn't followed him after all. Perhaps he should go back and check. A long, low creak cut through the quiet, the unmistakable sound of a sneaking foot pressing on a floorboard. Aaron whirled, heart thumping hard. He was standing in the middle of a tight corridor with several doorways. Further along, a narrow stairway led to the deck. He saw no one, but somebody was here. An image flurried into his mind, a vision of the Eluru captain cobbled together from stories and a painting he'd once seen. He was tall, pale, and sharp as an icicle, with hair the colour of new snow. His features were haughty and beautiful, his mouth thin and cruel, his ears without lobes. He'd come striding from the dark, a shade striped in sunlight, the tattered tails of his fish-eaten jacket flapping behind him, and a long, narrow sabre of grey witch-iron in his hand. Aaron could hope for no mercy from him, for his kind had none. Panic bubbled up in his gut as he realised what an awful miscalculation he'd made. He should never have come here, never have risked this. But Jed and the others still waited for him outside, and he was afraid of the beating he'd get if they caught him. Paralysed by indecision, he dithered in the corridor, searching for danger but doing nothing to escape it. "Yah!" Aaron screamed and flailed his arms in front of his face as his attacker leapt out from a doorway. So violent and surprising was his reaction that his attacker screamed as well. After a few moments, when Aaron appeared not to be dead, he dared to lower his arms. Standing uncertainly before him was a pudgy boy he vaguely recognised from town. He was wearing a woolen blanket round his neck as a cape, and holding a carved wooden short sword. Remembering himself, the boy squared his shoulders and levelled the makeshift weapon. "Surrender!" he demanded. "Who are you?" Aaron asked, bewildered. "I'm King Halfdan Erdsbane," the boy declared. He brandished his sword. "And this is the Ember Blade of old." "Who are you really, though?" "Oh." He deflated, disappointed that Aaron wasn't playing along. "I'm Cade. You're Aaron, ain't you? I've seen you about." He stuck his sword awkwardly in his belt. "What are you doing?" "I'm hiding." "You ain't doing the best job of it," Cade observed. "Well, I haven't found a hiding place yet," Aaron said testily. "Who are you hiding from?" Aaron shrugged as if it was no big thing. "Jed, Ham and Dara, they want to beat me up." "Why?" "I hit Jed." "Why?" Because he'd said some things about Aaron's father and the elegant, pretty women who sometimes came to dinner at the house, and who were often there at breakfast too. Sometimes they were Croden, sometimes Ossian. Some he only saw once, others would visit frequently. Aaron thought them fascinating, especially those that spoke sweetly to him and gave him toys. But they made him feel odd as well, like something was happening that he didn't understand. Every so often, Randall would sit him down and tell him very seriously that nobody would ever replace his mother, and not to be worried, even though Aaron had been thinking nothing of the sort. Then there'd be no women for a while, but eventually a new one would appear. He didn't really know what Jed had been implying when he said what he said about Randall. He didn't even really remember the words, but it had the tone of an insult, and it touched a nerve,
and since he didn't know how to respond with his tongue, he'd used his fists instead. But Aaron couldn't explain all that to Cade. He could barely explain it to himself. All he knew was that he didn't want to talk about his father anymore. So he turned the question back on Cade. "Why are you here?" he asked, making it an accusation.
"I'm pretending," Cade said. He tugged at the end of his cape to show Aaron.
"On your own?"
"Nobody else wanted to."
"Aren't you scared of the Eluru captain?"
"I've been here loads of times and never seen him."
"What if the tide comes in?"
"I'll swim," Cade said, as if it was obvious.
Aaron smiled. Having some company pulled the sting from his fear, and Cade was reassuringly blithe about the danger. The galleon felt a lot less scary with him here. Cade saw his smile and smiled back eagerly.
"You want to play pretend with me?" he offered.
A plan hatched in Aaron's mind, and his smile became a grin. "Yes," he said. "Let's play pretend." While Aaron had been inside the galleon, Jed, Dara, and Ham had been squabbling on the beach. They argued and cajoled, whined and threatened, changed their minds and changed them again. Finally, Ham went home, walking at first until Jed threw a rock at him and he took to his heels. Then Jed and Dara picked up their sticks and climbed onto the ridge where the hulk of the wave dancer lay.
"We're coming for you, Aaron," Jed shouted.
Cade turned away from the gap in the planking through which he'd been watching.
"They're coming for you," he said excitedly.
"I heard," Aaron told him dryly. He pushed a strand of kelp away from his face.
"How do I look?"
Cade gave him a double thumbs up. Aaron wasn't sure his disguise was as convincing as the other boy made out, but his enthusiasm was heartening. He was wearing a ratty rug they'd found near a bulkhead with some empty bottles of wine. His shoulders and head were draped with straggling water weeds and black leathery chains of snapfish eggs. Cade's cloak had been tied around his head in a bundle to secure the cap of oozing kelp in place, giving the impression of long green hair hanging over his eyes and down to his waist. The costume of an Eluru captain was beyond them, but the shambling shade of a drowned boy would do well enough in a pinch. At least Aaron hoped so.
"You'll be waiting where we said?"
Cade hefted a rusty chain onto his shoulder, which they dug out of the water on the lower decks.
"Oh, aye," he said, hardly able to contain his glee. "Reckon I know what to do."
They headed off through the galleon to their appointed spots. The day had turned again, and this time in Aaron's favour. Meeting Cade had changed everything. No longer alone, he'd found his courage, and with a willing accomplice at his side, anything felt possible. Cade had suggested the best spot for an ambush, a dark chamber which Jed and Dara would have to pass through on their way in. It had been a cabin once, but the roof was rotted through, the mattress had dissolved to rags, and the bed frame had collapsed. At one end was a shadowed compartment that had once been a wardrobe or a storage cupboard, now empty but for rat's droppings. Aaron made some last-minute adjustments to his costume, which kept wanting to slip off, and then hunkered down in the wardrobe to wait. He didn't have to wait long. They came whispering and hissing to one another, creeping on wary feet with their sticks ready to defend themselves.
"I bet the captain's already got him," Dara said. "We ought to go."
"Shut your mouth," said Jed. "He's in here somewhere."
"I think I hear the tide coming in."
"I said clam it, scabwit."
Aaron tensed as they reached the doorway. Now it came to it, he felt his bravery ebbing. Maybe he could let them pass by and sneak out when they were gone. Wasn't that a better plan than confronting them? He watched from his hiding place as they crept into the room and wondered if he'd be able to move at all when the time came. The crash of chains from overhead killed his qualms. The game was on, and there was no going back.
"What was that?"
Dara gasped, as the two boys turned their eyes to the ceiling. He was answered by a shriek of such blood-curdling horror that they physically cringed from it. Suddenly the chamber was full of noise, crashing, howling, stamping.
Dust sifted down from the rotted boards overhead as they were pounded from above.
"It's the captain!"
Dara squeaked. But of course it was Cade, who'd watched the boys enter through the holes in the ceiling and was now doing a thoroughly convincing job of playing the spectre. He was throwing himself about and screaming his throat roar. Aaron was so impressed that he almost forgot to do his part, but inspired by his accomplice's performance, he surged out into the chamber. Arms raised, moaning like the dead, he stumbled towards Jed and Dara, a mass of weed and rags that was transformed in their minds into a dreadful apparition. They screamed at the sight of him. Everyone was screaming now, and stumbled back in abject panic, dropping their sticks. Then there was a loud crack from above, and Cade plummeted through the ceiling with a crash of chains and falling timber. Jed and Dara ran, shrieking at the tops of their lungs, back the way they came. They were still shrieking when they reached the beach. Cade groaned, sloughing off broken planks as Aaron helped him to his feet. He dusted himself down, wincing as new bruises made themselves known, then caught Aaron's eye and began to chuckle.
"Did you hear 'em?" he said. "We got 'em, didn't we?"
"We got them," Aaron agreed. He was giddy with victory. Then, on impulse, he said, "Do you want to be friends?" "All right," said Cade. And so it was. We let Jed and Dara tell everyone how they'd seen the captain and lived. Then we let on what we'd done, Aaron said. He'd lost himself in memories, but now the sounds and smells of the infirmary intruded again, and he was reminded of the hunger in his belly and the pain in his muscles. A loud scream came from the surgery as the amputation began. He ignored it and tried to smile. "They never lived it down. I swear that was half the reason Jed apprenticed as a navigator, just to get out of Shoal Point." Cade had fallen quiet, and now he turned restlessly in his bunk, eyes roving. Aaron gripped his hand and attempted to catch his gaze. His story had done some good, it seemed. He dared to believe his friend had calmed at the sound of a familiar voice.
"Cade? Can you hear me?"
"Icky, picky, spit, spat, spot,"
Cade whispered urgently. It was a snatch of a children's rhyme they used to sing in the plazas. Now the whole thing tumbled from his lips.
"Spit, spat, spot, better epoxy than not. The old man's hot to keep safe from the rot. Hide in the stables till the bolt gets shot. Icky, picky, spit, spat, spot."
The hope in Aaron flickered and died. Was this all that was left of his best friend? A witless buffoon, swinging between hysteria and delirium? Had the Crodans taken the last person he loved? He shied from that thought, overcome with guilt and the fear of some unknown punishment. But the sight of his friend muttering and babbling made him angry. "Say it," he told himself. "Say it out loud."
"Crodans did this," he said. "Crodans put us here. Crodans hurt you."
Cade rolled to his side, clutching his sheets, mumbling nonsense. Aaron checked if anyone had heard him, but all the patients nearby were asleep or unconscious. To say it was blasphemy. He'd never thought of the Croden people as enemies before, never dared to. The Primus would hear, the Iron Hand would know. And yet, seeing Cade condemned to idiocy set something boiling inside him, bubbling up till he could taste rancid hate on the back of his tongue. For the first time, he no longer cared what retribution might come. If Cade didn't recover, he'd never forgive them. He swore it. The patient in the surgery was still screaming. He heard Kel shouting from the back of the infirmary,
"Dracontears! We need more Dracontears for the pain!"
Other patients groaned for aid as helpers busied themselves among the beds. Aaron ignored it all. The world had shrunk to the width of Cade's bunk.
"I'll look after you," he said quietly,
and those words pushed tears to his eyes.
"I won't let them give up on you."
He searched Cade's face for any sign that he'd been heard, but found none. He hung his head and slowly let go of his friend's hand. An immense sadness welled up in him, an ocean of sorrow so deep and wide that he knew there'd be no limit to it.
Meshuk, Stone Mother, I called on you to save him. I even thought you might have answered me. But you're just a fiction like all the other aspects, like the Primus, like love, like my father, like every other thing I believed in.
Aaron?
His head shot up at the sound of Cade's voice. Cade was staring blindly upwards, pawing at the air above his bunk.
Aaron, is that you?
Yes, he cried, and grabbed Cade's hand again. Yes, I'm here.
I was far away, Cade said dreamily. Then I heard your voice.
Yes, yes, I was talking to you. Can you see me? He was desperate, eyes glittering, overwhelmed with emotion and exhaustion.
You're so dim, like a shade, he coughed weakly. Aaron?
Yes?
There's something I need to ask you.
Yes?
I just need to know.
Yes? Cade's eyes focused on him, and he raised an eyebrow.
When did you become such a blubberin' sap?
Aaron gaped. Cade grinned. Then Aaron said very slowly and very clearly,
You absolute bastard.
Cade whooped with laughter as Aaron pounced on him, fending away Aaron's half-serious attempts to beat and strangle him.
You can't hit me, I'm crazy, he protested. I believed you, you maggot sack.
Shh, Cade motioned for him to keep it down.
I am mad, and I'm going to stay mad as long as they'll keep me here.
Aaron stopped assaulting him and sat back on his haunches. He was so relieved that his urge to murder Cade was temporarily forgotten.
You want to stay here?
3 square meals and I get to lie in bed all day, Cade replied. Ain't in a hurry to give that up.
You could have let on earlier.
But you were being so nice to me. Cade was making fun of him, but Aaron didn't mind a bit. If Cade was joking again, then his friend was back, and everything that had divided them had been pushed aside.
Listen, said Aaron, leaning closer. I understand now.
You were right.
Course I was, said Cade confidently.
About what?
We can't just survive in this place. We can't just wait it out. No one's coming to save us. No one's going to set us free.
Well, said Cade, his voice heavy with sarcasm, you know how to cheer a fella up, I'll give you that.
That's why we have to escape.
Cade's face became grave. Suddenly it was no longer a joke.
You mean it? He said. I promise you, said Aaron.
The moment he said it, he was certain.
We'll break out or we'll die trying, but I'll be God's damned if I'll let us fade away here. You got a plan? Cade asked eagerly.
He was about to say no, but before he could, the plan came to him, springing whole and clear into his mind. With a shock, he realized he must have been thinking about it all along, storing away details and information ever since they'd arrived. He just hadn't allowed himself to entertain the idea of escape until now. It was an inconceivable act of rebellion for someone who had such complete faith in the Croden way. That faith lay in shreds now. He was taking matters into his own hands.
I've got a plan, he said, and I need you to do something for me.
Do I have to get out of bed?
Luckily, you don't. You need to stay right here.
Do you still have your water flask? Cade shook his head.
I lost it in the explosion.
Take mine. Aaron pulled the tin flask from his belt, slugged the last of the water and handed it over.
You can hide it somewhere, but they won't even look inside if they find it. It's just a water flask. Everyone's got one.
Cade studied it, puzzled.
So what exactly do I have to do?
You have to pretend, said Aaron. You can do that, can't you?
Oh, yeah, said Cade, a wicked smile spreading across his face.
I can do that.
19. In the shadow of the Ostenberg Mountains lay the Aldwood, spreading thick and dark across the land from horizon to horizon. Its edges were dotted with small settlements and mazed with foresters' trails,
but few ventured deeper than that. Among the dense tangles at its heart lay places that hadn't known the tread of human feet for centuries. Wild tales were told of what lay within. Beasts of enormous size, shade-touched creatures that spoke as men, malevolent trees that would strangle the unwary or crush them with a falling branch. At the centre, overseeing all, waited something as old as time, vast and unknowable, which jealously guarded its land from invaders. Vika didn't know the truth of that, but she knew better than to dismiss such tales as nonsense. The old wood was enormous and strange, and though she'd walked deeper than most dared, much of it was still a mystery to her. Even for a druidess who knew the ways of the land, there were dangers. Ruck padded by her side as she followed a sunken path between the trees, hollowed out by a long-vanished stream. Knuckled roots poked from the earthen walls, and ancient trees creaked and groaned as she passed. It was evening, and the sun was still up, but beneath the canopy it was chilly and sombre. She'd travelled far since the Dirikum, and her journey had done nothing to cheer her. Everywhere the old ways were being forgotten, the signs of the Nine quietly erased. Shedding her druidic trappings, she'd ventured into a town to gather supplies and learn what she could. There she found a temple to the Primus, newly built on a hill overlooking the streets, a magnificent beacon of red and beige stone. There were no such monuments to the Nine, only neglected shrines and a temple falling into ruin. Small wonder they were losing the people. The young saw little evidence of the old gods of Ossia, and nothing of the druids who spread their wisdom. The Nine were part of their parents' world, but not of theirs. The only voice they heard was that of the Sanctorum at Festan Day Convocation, which taught that the Aspects were primitive gods, and denied them. She thought of the Champion, the bright figure with the Sword of Light, and then of the nightmarish creatures that had come after, and the vision they'd shown her. Something terrible was approaching. She only hoped she might make sense of what she saw while there was yet time to avert it. The crack of a twig made her stop and raise her head. One hand on her staff, she listened. Something had been tracking them for a while now, something large that kept its distance. Ruck growled low in her throat. "Be calm, my friend," said Vika, rubbing the scruff of Ruck's neck. "We are no enemies of this forest." And yet, she wasn't so sure that mattered these days. The spirits were not welcoming of late. They'd grown resentful and restless, less inclined to differentiate between the druids who sought to protect them and the crodens who cut down their trees for lumber and farmland. Another crack, louder and closer, and now she was concerned. She heard a woof of animal breath. Birds scattered explosively as a brake of ferns thrashed with the movement of some ungainly beast. From the undergrowth at the edge of the sunken path, the brown muzzle of a bear poked out. Vika stepped back in alarm as it ambled into the open and down to the stream bed, blocking her path. It snuffled at the air, turned its head towards her, and fixed her with a beady gaze. "Peace," she said, raising one hand. "We have no quarrel with you." The bear was in no mood to be pacified. It reared up on its hind legs, towering over them, and its lips peeled back from its fangs as it roared a challenge. "These woods are not safe, traveller. Haven't you heard?" Vika whirled at the voice. The woman had appeared silently behind her. She wore a thick, tattered cloak stitched with faded red and brown patterns. A voluminous hood shadowed her face, and she carried an elaborately carved oak staff, split into a fork at the tip, with the skull of a young goat fixed between the tines. "I dreamed your coming. Vika walks the barrows," the woman said in a low, slow voice. "You are expected." She raised her staff towards the bear and spoke words in an elder tongue. The bear gave a yawning cry, thumped down heavily onto its forepaws, then turned and plodded away up the path. The woman lowered her staff and pulled back her hood, revealing a head of short-cropped silver hair and a face smeared with two vertical streaks of red paint. Her lips spread into a smile.
10 years it has been, my erstwhile acolyte, and now you return an equal.
Agali sings the dark, said Vika, spreading her arms. I've searched long to find you.
You are welcome, said the older woman, and the two druidesses embraced in a warm clutch of furs and bodies.
Agali's camp was in a glade by a narrow stream, roofed with tangled branches. A tent of sticks and hide stood to one side of the glade, a fire at the other, ringed by stones. The night insects were loud, and glowflies danced above the water. Vika and Agali sat together on a tuffet, eating seared dough meat off the spit and mushrooms and potatoes fried in fat, which they ate from the pan. A skin of slow liquor lay between them. Ruck gnawed a bone, lazy in the warmth of the flames.
"And what did you see after the spirit uncovered your eyes?" Agali asked.
Vika stared into the fire, a frown settling on her face as the memories flooded back.
"The dark figures were gone," she said. "I was still in the hollow, but it was withered and dead now, and the sky was strange. I went to the edge of the Dirikum, where it was open to the hills, and saw..."
Her breath shuddered as the sight hit her anew. Ruck looked up from her bone and whined.
"It was madness, Agali. An ever-changing wasteland, where the wretched remnants of humanity were prey to monsters from beyond the divide. I saw an armless creature, with a white face like a mask, chained like a beast of burden to a spiked cart overflowing with body parts. Twisted, fanged things lunged and snapped at a ragged woman as she fled across a cracked plain. There was something chitinous and gigantic with a shape part spider and part flea, which stalked along the horizon, while behind it a black sun rose vast and close.
She swallowed, and her gaze was distant, blurred by tears of horror.
Beyond the wasteland there was a city, a sprawling vileness upon the parched earth, with avenues of sinew and towers of bone and knuckle. The stretched and screaming faces of those who died to build it still yawned on the walls of its cathedral. Rivers of blood and body fluids spilled in falls from aqueducts of gristle. It steamed in the heat of the rising sun, and cackling things ran in the streets, imps of the abyss and worse and worse and worse.
She came to a stop. She could say no more. She wiped tears away, irritated at herself for letting them fall, and waited for Agali to speak.
"You were right to come," said Agali at length. "Matters are grave, if what you have seen is to be trusted."
"If," said Vika,
"the spirits deceive, and never more so than now."
"Perhaps," said Agali,
"but I too have seen omens. I walked beneath a storm and watched lightning carve the sign of Azra into the sky. I dreamed I heard pounding beneath the earth, as if some great creature fought to be free of its prison, and when I awoke, the pounding still shook the forest. Nor am I blind to what is happening in our land, and now you bring me this news."
She handed the skin of liquor to Vika, who swigged from it. Heat bloomed pleasantly in her chest, and she recovered a little.
"Then give me wisdom, Agali. If it's news, I don't understand it."
The flames made shadows in the lines of Agali's face.
"The dark figures you saw, the mutilated horrors with flayed skin, you were visited by the torments."
"The torments do not cross the Shadowlands."
"Not for many years. But that is how the lore keepers described the torments to me, though I remember little else they said about them."
She shrugged.
"It was a long time ago. If my mind made perfect records, I would be a lore keeper myself.
Vika took another swig of liquor to stave off the cold thought that she'd seen the keepers of Kaer Vishnach, the citadel on the far side of the Shadowlands that guarded the way to the abyss. Kaer Vishnach, which hung suspended on chains over an immense and bottomless pit where the outsiders languished, imprisoned for eternity.
"These are black days when the torments themselves leave the citadel of chains to bring us warning," she muttered.
"The outsiders stir in the abyss, and Azra the Despoiler strains at his bonds. All that lies ahead is death and war and destruction," Agali said despondently. "These are black days indeed."
"What I saw, the ruin of the land, they were showing me the future?"
"A future, perhaps." Agali threw another stick of wood on the fire. "Once there was only chaos upon the face of the world. The living and the dead shared the same earth, and nothing was certain."
Her eyes became distant, and her voice took on the tone of a recitation. It was a story well known to them both.
"It was the age of chaos, when the outsiders ran amok and brought corruption and disorder to all the Creator had intended. Joha saw that nothing good could thrive there, so he drew the divide across the world, the great chasm separating the living and the dead."
"To the living, the world beneath the sun," Vika murmured. "To the dead, the Shadowlands."
"But the outsiders resisted, so Joha led the Aspects in war against them. For 1,000 years they fought, till at last the outsiders fell. For their actions, Joha condemned them to the abyss and set the torments to watch over them."
Agali plucked a steaming potato from the pan and bit into it.
"But they have never stopped coveting the light. Always they are seeking their freedom and vengeance upon those that took it from them. If they are ever released, all you have seen will come to pass."
"Something has changed then," said Vika, frowning. "It has been 1 century since they last threatened the world of the living, and we've heard nothing of them since. What new danger brings their wardens to warn us?"
"That is what we must discover," said Agali. "Perhaps the champion you saw can provide the answers."
"I did not see their face, Agali. How am I supposed to find them?"
"The Aspects will give you guidance."
Vika shook her head sadly. "It has been long since I heard their voices."
She watched Ruk, worrying at her bone in the firelight. Here in the forest, with a strong drink in her belly and Agali next to her, she felt a soft, sad yearning for a simpler life. No more wandering, no more hiding from Crodan druid hunters. All she wanted was fire, food and good company, with Ruk at her feet. It wasn't much to ask. Better that than all this doubt, all this supplication with only silence as an answer. Better than bearing the burden of faith.
"I think the gods have left this land, Agali," she said. It was the first time she'd spoken it aloud, and it was like a stone laid on her heart. She looked over at her mentor, the woman who'd trained her in the ways of the druids. Tears came to her eyes, loosened by liquor. "I'm not sure they were ever here at all,"